The new season proves Better Call Saul remains one of the finest shows on television, with visually ambitious storytelling used to depict complex characters headed for a tragic end. That's from Eric Deggans of NPR. Better Call Saul is one of the shows we're talking about this time here on Cinephile. Again, a more TV-slanted version here of Cinephile, as right now everybody is self-quarantining. Hope everybody is safe and at home right now. I'll also be talking about The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel Season 3. We're six episodes in A Better Call Saul, watching that in real time, but I was able to binge-watch Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and I'll have my review of that coming up. Also, I'm not exaggerating here. This is one of the best guests we've ever had on the show. Patrick Gallo, who was in my favorite movie of the year, The Irishman, and was in my favorite scene of the year when Pacino and Stephen Graham, Jimmy Hoffa and Tony Pro go back and forth after they're trying to reconcile. Tony Jack is Patrick Gallo, the actor who is going to join me today on Cinephile. He tells some unbelievable stories about being in that scene with Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, 8 hours it took them to do the scene. Stories about Scorsese, how he got the role. I can't undersell it enough. Trust me, it's one of the best interviews we had on Cinephile. You're going to want to listen to Patrick Gallo, his stories of The Irishman, Al Pacino, and Bob De Niro, and so much more. Plus, we'll do our Mount Rushmore, as always, and Total Recall, the movies of 1997, which is 1998 Academy Awards. The reason I want to do this is I talked about Yulia's Gold last week, and I kept thinking, like, how the hell did Peter Fonda not win Best Actor? So I wanted to go back to that year, because Fonda won a litany of awards in critics groups prior to the Oscars for Yulia's Gold, but didn't end up winning the Oscars. So we're going to redo that year of 1997. You may remember it because of another major name, and that would be James Cameron and Titanic. We'll get to that in just a second. But first, let's do some reviews here, folks. Better Call Saul, one of the best shows on TV, isn't it? In season five of the critically acclaimed show, Jimmy McGill's decision to practice law as Saul Goodman creates unexpected and profound waves of change throughout Albuquerque's legal and illegal circles. Kim Wexler finds herself at a crossroads as her connection with Jimmy deepens. Racked with guilt and regret, Mike Ehrmantraut hits rock bottom. Meanwhile, Nacho Varga tries to survive as Gus Fring's covert war on the cartel becomes a life-and-death chess match with the mercurial and relentless Lalo Salamanca. You know, this was such a big risk. I mean, this was such an enormous risk. I mean, you got to have a pair on you to do this, what Vince Gilligan did. You put together Breaking Bad, which is one of the greatest dramatic shows of all time, and then say, you know what? I want to keep going with this. I love the locale, the image, and we're going to do a spinoff with the comic relief character of Jimmy McGill. And it's like, well, hang on a second. Bob Odenkirk is amazing on Breaking Bad because it's a small character. It's comedic doses. He comes in for 5 or 10 minutes. He's amazing. He steals the scene, steals the episode, but then that's it. Nobody wants to see this guy for an entire episode. Like, he's a clown. It's a one-note joke. He's a huckster lawyer. He's a shyster lawyer. And Odenkirk plays him brilliantly because he's such a fast talker and smarter than people realize. But he has no scruples. He has no moral upstanding. He will help criminals like Walter White and Jesse and help anybody because he's in it for himself. Now, who the hell would want to watch that for an entire show? But Vince Gilligan said, no, we got something here. And that's why Mount Rushmore is going to be the greatest spinoffs of all time. Because I think it was just so smart of him to realize that there was storytelling to be done with Jimmy McGill, whereas I, like many others, I think, were skeptical, of how well it was going to work out. And from the beginning, it hit the right note, because Jimmy McGill, as I mentioned on Breaking Bad, is funny. He's an entertaining character. And he still has lots of funny moments on Better Call Saul. But this is not a comedic show. This is a dramatic show. And whereas Breaking Bad, his character was light and funny and, you know, twisting all around and able to circumvent all the menace that was around him, this is a tragedy. Like, make no mistake, this is about a guy who had integrity named Jimmy McGill, who then is beaten down by life and morphs into a crook named Saul Goodman. And it's to Odenkirk's credit that he's able to play the character with such subtlety. You know, you often look at comic actors who can do drama so well, and Odenkirk, you can add to that list of Jim Carrey or Mike Myers or so many others, Tom Hanks, of course, along the way. And that's why, you know, Odenkirk succeeds in the show, because he's unafraid of where the journey is taking him. He knows where Saul Goodman ends up because he's already played the role. Now it's a matter of showing all the little steps along the way. And season five in particular has been really strong out of the gate. I thought season three and four maybe get a little wayward. You know, at times it is slow pacing and you could kind of rev this sucker up a little bit. But I do appreciate that Vince Gilligan does not waste any time. Visually, it's astonishing. I mean, you watch an episode of Better Call Saul and you go, what's the budget on this thing? And it's just so unique the way they shoot it. And they see, you know, long lenses and that beautiful New Mexico landscape. They'll always look for unorthodox moves with which to begin a scene or end a scene. This is just visually speaking. And the writing is always so smart. The episodes always end not on a cliffhanger, but on a surprise note. Whether it's Kim and Jimmy, you know, throwing beer bottles off a balcony, or the episode that's just happened Monday night in which she suggests they get married after saying maybe they should break up and end this thing. I mean, it's he knows how to end an episode and to keep his audience hooked. Gilligan is just a master storyteller in those respects. The one aspect that I do miss, for those who have not seen the show and you want to go binge watch it, first of all, you should. And if you do, you realize one of the best aspects of the show, which I really miss a lot, was Michael McKean. Talk about another comedic actor playing Jimmy's brother. And he played him so well. I mean, this is an older brother that Jimmy reveres. And the way that McKean plays him is he's brilliant, but he's also ruthless and mean-spirited towards Jimmy and just cold and bullying at times and contemptuous of his little brother who he does not take seriously, who's not at his level. And yes, there's love there because they're brothers, but at the same time, you know, Jimmy's affection for his older brother is stronger than the brother's for his younger sibling. And amidst that tough outer shell is this heartbreaking vulnerability. And McKean's character suffers from this terrible mental illness. And the fact he's terrified of anything with electronics and, like, you know, he wraps himself in foil paper when he goes outside the house. And the way they shoot it, I mean, that character is one of the most underrated characters ever, I think, in a TV show. Michael McKean was able to do playing Jimmy McGill's brother. It's amazing. And I remember my brother told me, Vince Gilligan said that the inspiration for it is my favorite documentary, which is called Crumb. That's about Robert Crumb, who is the famous underground cartoonist who had these just tormented upbringing, and it was able to mine some humor out of that and put that into his art and this underground comics, which became a huge sensation. But he's got these brothers who are just so demented and twisted. And I guess that's where Gilligan found some inspiration for it. The rest of the supporting cast is also uniformly strong. Not only Mike Ehrmantraut, of course, that character is so good. Jonathan Banks is the actor who plays him. Again, you remember him from Breaking Bad. Giancarlo Esposito, who was so good on Breaking Bad, he's back once again. But the real find here is Rae Seahorn as Kim Wexler. I think she's flat out one of the best actresses working in television right now. I could watch Rae Seahorn do anything. I think she is so perfect in that role with that hair pulled back and that button, those business suits and such icy reserve. I mean, maybe it's just because I love old movies so much, but I swear she reminds me of like Kim Novak, straight out of Vertigo. Like, it's amazing watching her performance because, you know, she's attractive, but she's also very buttoned up and very repressed. And you can feel all this emotion bubbling under the surface, and she tries to keep it there. And she loves Jimmy. She loves him more than anything, but realizes that her conscience is getting the better of her and that she can't keep going down this path of trying to, you know, evade the law with these smart moves, which eventually, it's like you know when you're in trouble, eventually it's going to catch up to you. And that's what her face is etched with that all the time. But again, she's got genuine emotion for Jimmy, especially after her brother passes. I mean, after his brother passes, excuse me, in the scene where she starts crying for reading the letter. I mean, that's about as good as screen acting gets. And the first season has an episode which just focused on Mike and his backstory, which happened to his son. That episode's a great standalone episode. If you haven't seen it, go back and watch that. Straight out of a film noir, Mike going back into his former life. So listen, Better Call Saul, it's as good as it gets on television. I'm giving it 4 Maple Leafs. I'm just amazed they were able to pull it off, and it's must-see television, Joe, in my opinion.
I'm glad you're beating the Rhea Seahorn drum, because after the 2019 Emmy nominations came out, she was the number one person everyone was saying, how could you not give a nomination to Rhea Seahorn for Better Call Saul? She's the best thing on the show, so I'm glad to hear that confirmation from you.
Oh, I agree, man. Like, it's tough to top Odenkirk because he's so likable and so endearing, but I will echo those sentiments. Rhea Seahorn is the best part of Better Call Saul. I think she could do anything. I swear to God, if I could buy stock in an actress, I'd buy it in her, because I think she's so good at playing that role. I mean, and you're right, I get to a crime at this point. They're into season 5, for God's sakes. They're only have one more season after this. This is the penultimate year, and she's never been nominated for an Emmy. I mean, she did our boy Feinberg's podcast, Hollywood, Hollywood Chatter, for the Hollywood Reporter, excuse me, Awards Chatter, which you should all listen to. And I remember Scott, you're right, he was appalled afterwards that Rae Seahorn was snubbed. It's just, it's shocking. But she's great. The show is great. So check it out if you get a chance. Next show to talk about is The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Season 3, I just binge-watched. Again, this is a real awards favorite. Won the Emmy Award for Best Comedic Show for season 1. I believe season 2 lost to Fleabag. although maybe one for season two. Joe will fact check me on this, the Emmy history here of Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. But Rachel Brosnahan is one for Best Actress. She's amazing. As I talked to Feinberg previously on Cinephile, Al Pacino, of all people, my favorite actor. You know, when they were getting him to do Hunters, he didn't really know much about Amazon Prime, so they gave him Marvelous Mrs. Maisel to watch. And he loves Rachel Brosnahan. Like, he literally was saying this to Feinberg. He's like, oh, my God. Like, what do you want? What does Al Pacino watch at night? He watches The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. And he's like, ah, bro, that girl, she's great. Rachel Brosnahan. Like, he's just raving about Rachel Brosnahan in his Upper West Side apartment. But she's amazing. Again, speaking of great actresses, this should be the great actress in a file. Not only is it Rae Seahorn, but Rachel Brosnahan, I think, as gifted as a comedic actress right now on television. She's just beginning what I think is going to be a wonderful career. Because again, for what that show is about, Maisel, for those who are unaware, listen, she is this 1950s housewife, okay? She's stuck behind a life that is frustrating, but then realizes her gift is in comedy. And after her husband's cheating on her and wants to leave her, she goes and does stand-up and it becomes a huge hit. And with that unlikely premise, it becomes a really endearing show. Season 3 specifically, Midge and Susie discover that life on tour with Shy is glamorous but humbling. They learn a lesson about how show business they'll never forget. Joel struggles to support Midge while pursuing his own dreams. That's her ex-husband. Abe embraces a new mission. That's Tony Shalhoub. And Rose learns that she has talents of her own. By the way, a couple more blurbs I want to read on Better Call Saul. I'm going back now. Better Call Saul from Richard Nguyen Ferguson of The Observer. Better Call Saul continues to be the consistently underrated best thing on Netflix since the start of its penultimate series a few weeks ago. It's bowling along with its slow but unstoppable momentum. And Ben Travers of IndieWire, all of these consistently astonishing formal touches combine to create a value that outweighs the pain. Yes, Better Call Saul is a double-edged sword of reward and loss, but it isn't too sad to watch because you're too invested to look away. Man, those are some good blurbs. All right, back to Maisel, which is a completely different show. It's light. It's fairly... Listen, a lot of shows you have to find some personal affection for. I love the era of the 1950s, despite the virulent racism. I wish I could have been alive at that time. I love the songs. I love the cars. I love the clothes. And Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, more than anything, is tremendous eye candy. 8 episodes I binge watch, and I just look at that and I marvel at the production design. They must put so much effort and money into the meticulous nature of finding all the details right. Literally, the color of her clothes, Mrs. Maisel, like, it's just so bright and frilly. The Steadicam work is amazing. I mean, you talk about great directing on TV shows. Watch an episode of Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and look at that Steadicam. Like, these are like orchestrated shots. They must do take after take of rehearsal. In many ways, it reminds me of a play because especially when they're in the apartment, I mean, the camera just swoops in and watches them as they go off and on. And I mean, the dialogue is so rat-a-tat-tat. It's like a Neil Simon play. You know, it's like Lost in Yonkers or something. Helped by the fact, of course, it's New York Jews in 1950s, but it's got that whole rhythm to it, which I think is amazing. And I think that rhythm and that energy translates on the screen. My concern with it is I think at times it's a little bit light. Much like eye candy, is there real much substance to it? In the first few episodes, I think there's really not a whole lot of meat on the bone. But episodes 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, so the second half, which is to say, is very, very strong. And I think it's smart because it starts to look at commentary, not only about this housewife who's become unshackled as this new wave of women, independent woman. I mean, the husband's raising the kids. She's off on tour doing comedy. But also for African-Americans, the character Shy Baldwin, the great Sterling K. Brown, who Joe and I love. He plays the manager for Shy Baldwin, who is the lead singer, the concert tour that Maisel's on. Sterling K. Brown can do no wrong as well. He's awesome in the show. I wish he actually got to do more. It's a supporting role, but he's always tremendous. And I mean, the rest of the cast, Alex Borstein is really funny. She's on Family Guy. I believe she does the voice of Meg. She plays the manager, Susie. She's got a handful of great lines. I mean, at one point they're putting a face mask on and she goes, what is this? Just sits on your face like a French whore. I mean, she's tossing out one line after one like that. And of course, I haven't even mentioned yet, my favorite part of the show, Tony Shalhoub, one of my favorite actors, Big Night, one of the all-time classics. I've never even seen Monk. And yet I just love Tony Shalhoub from Green Bay, huge Packers fan. This season, there's not a whole lot of him. That's my only criticism of this season. There's not a whole lot of Shalhoub. His storyline, I don't think, had much meat on the bone. Him and the character of Rose Weissman, his wife, played by Maren Hinkle. But Shalhoub, if you watch the first two seasons, it's amazing. And again, Joe will verify, he's definitely won at least one, if not two Emmys for his performance as Abe Weissman. Definitely won like a SAG award as well. So ultimately, I like the fact that they're not looking at female empowerment, but also racism and just the emptiness of showbiz life. But again, back to the energy and the style. There's one episode which starts the first 10 minutes. First 10 minutes, I swear to God, there's no let up. There's no cut. It's just her. Well, there's cuts, obviously, editing. But I mean, in terms of the rhythm and the movement, there's no let up. As far as Maisel, to supplement her income, starts doing voiceover work. And her and Susie start going to all these different places. I mean, the cabs are flying around, the music's rolling, the camera's rolling, the music, the audio. I mean, it's just, it's like a symphony for the senses. And it really is an example of just how talented the people are who make The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. It's available on Amazon. Obviously, I love the music. I mean, a ton of Louis Prima. You got Sinatra. Amy Sherman-Palladino and Daniel Palladino are the executive producers. Amy Sherman-Palladino is the creator of it. Some reviews. Some of these are a little bit tepid. Matthew Gilbert of the Boston Globe. It can be a fun diversion, sweet in its willful irrelevancy, and alluring in its jovial rhythms. That's pretty good. Sophie Gilbert of the Atlantic. It's frustrating because the show keeps hinting that it's edging toward more substantial fare, only to back out at the last minute. I think in the first few episodes, that's accurate. I think later on, it does actually have more substance. And Ben Travers of IndieWire. Season 3 could rebound in its back half. The focus just shift. Real problems could arise. And Brown, speaking of Sterling K. Brown, could get that juicy arc he deserves. Even without all that, the first five episodes are sure to please diehard fans. Okay, well, he'd only seen the first five. I've seen all eight. I can tell you it's a show which is worthy of watching. And to close up, Joe, I often get criticized, rightfully so. My shows and my interests are so male-dominant. It's nice to have a show which is a female lead, which you can watch with your wife, your girlfriend, significant other. Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, 3.5 Maple Leafs.
I dig it. And just to follow up, Tony Shalhoub, he won Outstanding Supporting Actor in a comedy series at the 2019 Emmy Awards last fall, and Rachel Brosnahan won in 2018, and the show in 2018 won Outstanding Comedy Series.
Gotcha. So the second season didn't do as well. Shalhoub won for Supporting Actor, but Brosnahan did win for Lead, and the show won for Best Series.
Yep, yeah, and I will also mention that Alex Borenstein won for Supporting Actress at the Emmys last year as well. But yeah, definitely they cleaned up in 2018. 2019, they had a pretty good showing, but not nearly as dominant as 2018.
All right, Fleabag coming along for the ride as well.
Yeah.
All right, one more movie before we talk about some news which is affecting all of us, of course, coronavirus in the entertainment world. Bobby Walker, Ben Affleck. This movie's called The Company Men. 10-year anniversary of the movie, so I want to check it out. Never seen it before. And it's about Ben Affleck living the American dream. Great job, beautiful family, shiny Porsche in the garage. When corporate downsizing leaves him and co-workers Phil Woodward, Chris Cooper, and Gene McClary, Tommy Lee Jones, jobless, the three men are forced to redefine their lives as men, husbands, and fathers. Bobby soon finds himself enduring enthusiastic life coaching, a job building houses for his brother-in-law, played by Kevin Costner, which does not play to his executive skill set and perhaps a realization that there's more to life than chasing the bigger, better deal. I mentioned the movie because it's timely right now. I think we all know we're facing a real economic crunch, could be on the verge of another recession. And this movie came out just after the Great Recession and focused on, you know, the white-collar, white man, older, losing his job, and then realizing what's he supposed to do with his life and just how bloodless and how cruel the corporate world can be. Karen James of Newsday, with harrowing realism, The Company Men captures the raw personal impact of the economic meltdown. Also, Stephen Holden of the New York Times. Ben Affleck and Chris Cooper play characters who learn that in a company concerned about the bottom line, almost everyone is expendable. This movie may be a little too close to home right now, because I'm sure a lot of people right now are feeling the economic pinch. But I'm going to give it 2.5 Maple Leafs. I liked it for the cast of Affleck, Jones, and Cooper, and Kevin Costner playing this real hardworking laborer. I just found that, quite honestly, it's tough to have a lot of sympathy for a bunch of affluent white men. I mean, Affleck at one point is going for a job interview, and the woman tells him, how much are you making? He says, well, I was making 120 with bonuses, but I'm willing to settle for 110. And he says it with like this smarmy look on his face. And I'm like, listen, how can you build around a movie on these guys? And by the way, he's the cheapest of them. Chris Cooper's probably making at least $250. And Tommy Lee Jones is one of these like very rich, rich executives, like multimillionaire. So I just think it's tough to build a movie around those guys who are hard to be sympathetic for, as good as those actors are, and as much empathy as you can have for anybody who loses their job. Of course, no matter how much you're making, it's very sad to go through. I couldn't imagine the depression, and especially for these men who really see themselves and their self-worth through their job, which is why I still like the movie and I do recommend it. But I just think ultimately it's tough to rally around these guys when so many others have it so much worse off. Joe?
I couldn't put it any better than what you just said. And I'm kind of realizing right now that today is kind of a Ben Affleck-centric show, much like last week. I won't say much more, but stay tuned.
All right, exactly. Well done. Good tease. All right, so entertainment news to pass along. Netflix picking up Kumail Nanjiani, Issa Rae's The Lovebirds. A week after being pulled from its April 3rd theatrical release because of concerns about coronavirus, The Lovebirds going to Netflix. It was set to be released via Paramount, but instead now it's going to be on Netflix. It's directed by Michael Showalter, I recognize that name because he directed The Big Sick, Kumail Nanjiani's breakthrough movie. This is about following a couple on the brink of a breakup and then become embroiled in a bizarre and hijinks-filled murder mystery. So Hollywood grappling with the closure of U.S. theaters. You got many more movies now being sent to VOD and digital services weeks early. Speaking of, I saw The Hunt is now available here on DirecTV in North Jersey, Bergen County. I also saw The Invisible Man with Elizabeth Moss is available. But it's like $20. Come on, movie go, movie theaters, movie chains. Like, listen, I'm not paying $20. Give it to me for $10. I know, listen, the North Jersey price, which I've discussed, is like, you know, $14.25 to see a movie. So I got to pay more for this? I guess the thought is you're watching it with a spouse or with a partner, so $20, $10 each. No, normally I'm seeing movies solo here. Come on. This movie should be $10 right now. Like, I'm not going to pay $20 to go see The Hunt. And at least in this case, The Lovebirds is going to be on Netflix coming soon. I do really like Nanjiani's work. Speaking of Sonic the Hedgehog, which I had just been seeing in theaters and was robbed of, it's now going to be released early digitally. Paramount announcing it will now come out on March 31st on VOD in America. So Sonic, the latest movie to get accelerated toward the home market in the wake of nationwide closing. This is footsteps of movies like Bloodshot, The Way Back, and Pixar's latest classic Onward, which also is going to be available on VOD. So it's interesting right now for movie theaters. Do you wait to just release the movie, you know, in October or November? You know, like what the Bond movie is doing or A Quiet Place 2, or do you release the movie on Netflix like The Lovebirds is doing, or just try to put it on VOD, especially if it was just in theaters? Definitely a tricky time right now. There's no right answers here, Joe.
None whatsoever. And I guess whatever affects their bottom line the least. And so I guess if these production companies can make more money now by putting out on VOD and sacrificing the theatrical run, then that's what they're aiming to do. But good for us. I'll watch Sonic the Hedgehog. I liked your review a few weeks ago, so I'm excited to watch that on the 31st.
I love it. Go Jim Carrey. Other news, this year's Cannes Film Festival has been postponed. Organizers announced March 19th. New dates being considered for the end of June. Of course, this is one of the crown jewels if you're a movie fan. The 73rd edition was set to take place May 12th to 23rd. The event in its modern history has never been canceled. So the French government is now trying to go to late June for it. They've prohibited gatherings of 5,000 or more people in confined venues, which Cannes organizers insist would have no impact on the festival. The largest venue, the Lumiere Theater, seats 2,300 people, but the country later upped the ban to 1,000 people or more, so therefore that would impact as far as movies being seen. And also, hooray for Netflix. They're pledging $100 million in relief to out-of-work production community. This is going towards third parties and nonprofit providing emergency relief, so I know Netflix gets a lot of criticism, but it's nice to see the fact that they're giving some money towards people definitely in need right now. Now it's time for, I'm telling you, one of the best guests ever on Cinephile, Patrick Gallo, master storyteller right now.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
A pleasure to bring in Patrick Gallo. You can follow him on Twitter at Patrick Gallo, a guy who is a graduate of the prestigious American Musical and Dramatic Academy in New York City, acting, musical, theater, dance. He's done it all. And the reason I want to talk to him is because he's a part of my favorite film of 2019, which was The Irishman. And he's a part of my favorite scene, which we're going to dive into here in detail. Patrick, first and foremost, thanks so much for the time. Welcome to Cinephile.
Hey, thanks for having me, Adnan. It's a real pleasure to be here, brother.
Patrick, I have seen that scene at least a dozen times. I mean, I saw The Irishman three times in theaters. I saw it at the New York Film Festival twice. I saw it the Friday night when it debuted in September. And then I saw it the next day. I took my wife for like a Saturday noon showing. So twice in 24 hours. And then I saw it again with a buddy of mine a month later in Montclair, New Jersey. And now on Netflix, I mean, we have the pleasure of watching it over and over. But that scene, you're playing Tony Jack, for those who are unfamiliar, and you've got Al Pacino playing Jimmy Hoffa and Tony Pro, played by Stephen Graham, coming together. And that sit down with the two of them is so perfectly orchestrated from all levels. You know, the writing, obviously Scorsese's direction, Steve Zillion wrote the script. But I want to ask you about you specifically, because I think it's critical what you bring to the role and that scene in particular, because you and De Niro are both supposed to be guys who are in the middle, right? You're trying to reconcile these two guys. And I thought you were perfect as far as nailing the tempo of, hey, we're just trying to have a meeting here. Like, you know, just settle down, Jimmy. Like, take it easy. When Hoffa starts to lose his mind a little bit. But take me a step back. How did you get the part in the first place? Is it because I'm guessing you're in Boardwalk Empire, so Scorsese had some familiarity with your work?
I was called in to read for the role, and interesting how Scorsese does it, where, you know, a lot of the smaller roles in his films, you know, he'll kind of have one monologue, which was actually, so that a lot of actors will audition with that one monologue. That won't be the role, but he just wants to see that, and then he decides where he may want to use those actors. So actually, if you remember the Whispers to Tullio scene with De Niro at the table, that was the monologue that a lot of us read auditioned with. And then later on down the line, we found out, you know, when we found out we got cast, we were told what role it was. So that was it. I went in, I did that monologue. When he pitches to De Niro to go and check out the laundry, what was it called? The Cadillac, was it Cadillac Laundry?
Yeah, that's right.
Cadillac Laundry. So that was it. And I didn't really know. It was like a month or two before I even found out that I was on a veil being held for it, which that alone was like a mind blower. And then I found out that I booked it and then still didn't even find out what role it was until another like month down the road when I finally was told. So it was an interesting process because, you know, I'd tell people, hey, I got this role. And they'd be like, what is it? And I was like, not really sure. You know, it's hard to tell. But that was it. And then, you know, then of course it came to light that it was Tony Jack. And even through the whole process, though, the scenes kept changing, what we were going to do, a scene in an airport. And, you know, it was never really set until like, right before we would shoot, I would get the sides, and then it would be confirmed, this is the scene we're shooting, and this is where we're going to go.
Well, and I want to get into the exact verbiage in a second, but let me go through the fact, like you said, you get this role, you're telling your friends, hey, I've been in a Martin Scorsese movie, I don't know exactly what I'm doing, we'll figure it out. And then in the scene, you're with two of the greatest actors of all time, Al Pacino and Robert De Niro. How are you, like, as an actor, for all the actors listening, how are you able to, like, steady your nerves? Take me through the process. Like, how'd you sleep the night before? What were you doing as far as trying to just get in the character and realize, all right, hey, just breathe, just be you. You've been an actor for, you know, decades. Just get this thing done.
Yeah, it was intense. I mean, I didn't really know. I knew when I got the role that I was like, there's a good possibility that I could do a scene with either De Niro or Pacino. I thought that, but I was like, that's a long shot. You know, I thought if that happened, that would be unbelievable. And I had no idea, but I would tell my mother, it's possible. I don't know. You know, we didn't have much information. The night before I got the sides, which by the way, I had one line in the scene. In the script. But Marty, and I'll tell you about that, you know, Scorsese let us do a lot of improv and a lot more dialogue ended up in there. But as I was looking at the script the night before, I was like, Jimmy, Frank. And I told my wife, I was like, I think that Jimmy, that it's Pacino and De Niro. I think I'm in a scene with Pacino and De Niro. I had no idea, but I was like, I think I am, unless these are different characters. And then I got there in the morning and I was alerted to the fact that, you know, Bob and Al, that, you know, they said, we'll be coming to meet you and this and that. And I was like, I can't even really believe what's happening right now. I had to separate, you know, the fan. I had to separate the actor who was so inspired by these guys and was a fan of their work down to the tiniest grain of sand to say like, okay, put that aside. You're just a colleague with them. You're going to work with them. And it has nothing to do with what you've seen of them. It's right now. What's happening right now. You're a bunch of New York actors sitting at a table and you're working and that's it. And that's how they treated me. So when I got in the room and I met, Scorsese, which I had met on the, a couple of days or a month before that on another scene, and I met Al and Bob, and it was like, they were just like, you know, you were an equal. Immediately, you were an equal. And then we sat down at the, and then at the end, they kind of emptied out the, before we shot the scene, they emptied out the soundstage. And they get about 70 people out of the soundstage. They empty it out. And then the assistant comes over to me and says, okay, you know, Marty wants you to come in now. And I'm thinking, I know who's in that room. And I know it's Scorsese, De Niro, Pacino, and Stephen Graham. And I'm thinking, I don't believe, and I know no one else is in there. And they walk me in, and Martin Scorsese says, come on, Patty, come on, sit down at the table. And then I'm sitting at the table with them, and we're all talking about the dynamics of the scene. And it was just ridiculous. I was like, this is, I can't believe. And I felt totally, totally comfortable. I didn't feel judged. I felt like we're all equals. We're all there to work on a scene. We're actors. You know, it's about the craft. And that's all I felt. I felt total freedom. I was speaking. I was bringing, you know, Marty said, what ideas? How are we? Nobody knows how we're coming in. How are we going to walk in? And Stephen and I were like, all right, let's improvise some walking in and let's try it out. And he would say, great. Marty said, that's great. Perfect. That's it. That's it. So his trust in us and the choices that we were making were, he just fully 100% trusted us and let us dictate really how everything was going to go.
That's fascinating. I love the fact you're giving that kind of detail to it, because you're right, especially when you walk in, because you're right, that's a very subtle thing, but it's important that Stephen Graham walks in, Tony Pro, arms big, you come in, you know, big guy, you give De Niro a hug, give him a kiss on the cheek. You're right. Those details are so important as to like setting the scene and then what's to follow. So I love the fact it was so collaborative.
Yeah, and that was all improv. We literally, that when we walked in, Scorsese said, you know, it's not in the script. How are we going to come in? And Stephen and I walked in, and that's what we did. And that was it. He was like, okay, that's it. So what you saw there was us literally going, what do you think of this? Shake Jimmy's hand. I gave Frank a hug. We have a history. You know, me and, you know, it was, the dynamics were there. And that was what we did. And that's exactly what ended up in the cut.
I had read, and I love the fact that Scorsese allows you guys to ad-lib so much, because that's what I've always read, you know, whether it was Goodfellas or any number of his films, that he'll say, okay, here's what's on the page, and you guys go ahead. That whole scene with the 10 minutes that Pacino is insisting that that's what you should wait for someone who's late, and Stephen Graham's character saying no, 15, and then De Niro, I believe, ad-lib 12 and a half. I love the way that your character comes in and goes, beautiful, perfect. Like, that is such, that is like a perfect line
right
reading of
the
way you did it. Because again, you weren't overstating it. You're not like dominating the scene. De Niro gives the funny line, but your method of support, I think, is so perfect. The way you go, beautiful, beautiful, perfect, 12 and a half, perfect, right in the middle. Like, that's great.
Thanks, buddy. That's amazing to hear. Yeah, that was it. He totally, totally improvised that line. We did so much of that where we just sat there and we improvised so much dialogue. I mean, so much didn't end up in that scene because he let it. Even Pacino at one point said, We finished it, and Marty said, all right, cut, and we're going to, let's try it one more time. And Pacino went, Jesus Christ, Marty, what is this, a fucking play? Let's take it on the road. So.
That's amazing, because I remember, I mean, there's stories about, I remember Pacino, I mean, the famous scene in Heat with Hank Azaria. I spoke to Hank Azaria about that scene. You know, she's got a great ass, you get your head all the way up it. And Azaria goes, you don't understand. He goes, you know where that stems from. He goes, Michael Mann gives way too many takes. It's the worst. He goes, it should be 5 takes, 10 takes. He goes, he does like 30. I'm not exaggerating. He goes, so Al was so pissed by the end of it, and he was so exhausted. And Michael Mann kept telling him to do more. He goes, that's why Pacino is so cartoonish in that take. And like some critics criticize, like, oh, it's so over the top. I'm like, well, but Pacino was pissed off at that point. He's like, fine, you want to do a take? I'll give you a take. I'll go big. That's so funny that he said that.
Yeah. But he said it, and it was funny because it wasn't like frustration, because he knew, and we all, without question, it was the tone of the scene. It was one that we were kind of like always excited to like re-explore. Like every time we had to do another take, it's like, okay, like every little tone that it touches in the scene was so kind of like, there was such an ease to it all underneath the tension. And there was so much to play with that we were like, yeah, well, we could, I mean, I literally could have done that scene for 24 hours straight. It just never felt exhausting. It never would, considering who I'm sitting with, but it was just kind of like it flowed, and everybody kind of was like, it was real. Like, just a bunch of kids playing sort of a really fun, quiet game of Foursquare in the playground, you know?
Absolutely. And it's so funny. By the third time I saw it, I realized just how important the scene is, because to your point, it actually impacts everything. Because the only way that Pacino's Jimmy Hoffa agrees to the sit-down, which ends up leading to his death, is because of Tony Jack. And when De Niro is shocked to hear on the phone, he's like, "What, you changed your mind?" He's like, "Yeah, well, Tony Jack called me." He's like, "Really?" He's like, "Yeah, I mean, I like Tony." So that's critical what you are in that scene, because you can't be too abrasive towards Pacino. Otherwise, he wouldn't trust you later on. That's critical.
And I love that. And I love that moment. One of my favorite lines in the film too is when he goes, "You know, you know that's Pro's cousin." Emphasize that, you know. And I thought that was a great, great line.
Tell me about the wardrobe, because the purple pants. I mean, I can't get enough of that.
Ah, man, the wardrobe. What an exciting. I mean, Sandy Powell, was an extraordinary designer and you know, she's just an artist in her own right. She was amazing. I mean, we tried on so many different suits. And I have wide feet, so I remember one of the whole things is I tried on, oh my God, probably 30 pairs of shoes to find those little beautiful white shoes. But they had an amazing palette, you know, to create, you know, these scenes and all the wardrobe in these scenes, and the color palette for each scene is so emotional. It's got such an energy to it, you know, and the Miami stuff in particular, which was all sort of the blues and the pinks and the oranges, you know. I mean, it was just a pleasure to get into that wardrobe. You were, as soon as you put it on, you know, you're just like, this is exciting as hell. Because you know, as an actor, for me, and as soon as you know, you can do a lot of work on your character and. But when you put on wardrobe, man, there's a click, you know, things change, you know, you really sort of step through the doorway. And definitely when you would put these clothes on, these meticulously chosen articles of clothing that reflected the time and the scene, oh man, it was powerful. It was like putting on a cape.
Like I said, Sandy Powell is a legend, so I can only imagine the meticulous detail that goes with it. A cape, it's a purple pants with a cape. I love it. Did you at any point, and I'm going to assume the answer is no, but at any point did you feel like, can I lobby Scorsese at all to be in the movie a little bit more? Like, is there any way you could kind of, because he seems like a generous guy. Like you said, he's open to collaboration. Did you at any point feel like, hey, just pull him aside, hey, Marty, what if we add one scene of Tony Jack doing this? Like, what do you think? Can we do that?
I think at one point, let me remember what I said. I did say something, because he was, like I said, in the script I had one line. And now I think I ended up having, you know, five lines, you know, all improvised, which Marty said after, you know, after we had done a bunch of takes, he pulled me over and he's like, "You know what you're saying, so go ahead and just say it how you need to say it. Now I want to hear what you have to, how you are going to, you know, you give me Tony Jack in the scene." I said, okay. I'm thinking, I can't believe I'm just having a sidebar with Martin Scorsese right now. And he was so open to that. And that was it. So I ended up, you know, wrangling myself five lines. But at one point, I think jokingly, we were working something out. And I said, I said, this could be a good time for me to do like a whole monologue about traffic. And he, you know, started laughing about that. But that was like the most, you know, I was looking at it like, if I'm in the scene, if it's a flash of me for a frame, it's an experience I'm never going to forget. And I would never want to push it. It'll be what it is. It'll be what it's supposed to be. So, you know, if I didn't push any of that, you know.
No, but that's great that you actually gave that monologue line. He laughed about that, because I could just imagine you'd be so many actors just chomping the bit. But you were smart enough to go, listen, I'm just going to service the role. I'm going to get the thing done. But he was being inviting and giving. So you're like, all right, listen, we're playing back and forth here. It's fine. So it's like I said, it's an incredible film. It was my favorite film of the year. I think it's one of the best movies of the decade. I mean, trust me, I think it should have won every single Oscar out there. Trust me.
I'll tell you a great one last great little tidbit after the end of the after we finished shooting the scene. And we kind of shot it in order. So the last scene was the fight, you know, at the end. And, we shot that and, the scene was done, right? So Scorsese and De Niro kind of, you know, we say goodbye, they get whisked away. And as they're walking away from the table, I say to De Niro, I say, Bob, can I get a picture with you and Marty? And he reaches over a bunch of people that were kind of in the room, and he grabs my arm, and he pulls me through, and he says, Marty, come on, Patty wants to. Okay, now me, De Niro, and Scorsese are standing there, and we're laughing with each other, and we put our arms around each other, and we get ready to take this photograph. And we're standing there, and we all got our arms around each other, and after about 20 seconds, De Niro goes, did you get anybody to take the picture? And I did. So we were just standing there. No one was there to photograph the image. And then Rodrigo, the cinematographer, said, I'll do it for you. And then he came around. I gave him my phone, and then he shot it. And then right after that, as I was going to shake, they were leaving, and I went to shake De Niro's hand, and I poked him in the eye. And I was like, I'm so sorry. He's like, it's all right. Don't worry about it. You know, it was like, you know, there was such a great energy. You know, a lot of love, you know, and ease.
No, but you're like such, you know, consummate actor, right? Just get in there, just do the part, be professional. And then I think it's allowed. Like, I think it's perfect what you did was, hey, we're done. We're going home. Hey, can I just get a picture? Like, that is just a natural instinct for anybody. Like, I'm with two of the greatest of all time, actor and director. Like, hey, seriously, can we get a picture? Like, I think that's so good that you did that. Because I'm sure there's other people who'd be like, well, I don't want to bother them. Like, bother. You just shot all day. Of course, get a picture. It's no big deal.
Oh, yeah, I could listen, I wouldn't have done it if I didn't feel it, but we had been working together. I mean, we shot that scene. Remember, there was, you know, there's all of the CGI. There was so much involved in shooting scenes, camera crews, two different setups, and it was constant. It was so much. You know, we ended up shooting for, you know, 8 hours. That scene was literally all day. It was one day, that entire scene. So it was a lot of coverage that he got on it and all that. So, you know, we spent a lot of time together, and there was a comfort, and there was a, like I said, a mutual respect. Four actors sitting at a table with literally total support of each other, and an amazing director and crew, by the way. Every single person there, all the way down to the PAs, has the energy of, I'm working for Scorsese right now. This is amazing. You were where everybody wants to be, and everybody had that respect and put that energy into it. And even Pacino, when he left before we were done, because, you know, the stunt guy came in to do the major part of the scene, the fight scene. And I even got a picture with him, and he was the best. He grabbed me, his assistant grabbed him, and he said, come on, let's get a picture. And he grabbed my arm, and we have a picture of him with the arm around me, and he just went, you're good. And I was like, what the hell is happening right now?
Well, that's what I was about to say. It made me think of Field of Dreams. You know, Burt Lancaster, you know, playing Moonlight Graham, right? He got one at bat, yeah. Never got a hit, and then he leaves, becomes a doctor. Obviously, he comes back to the game they're having. He has to leave the game to attend to Kevin Costner's daughter. And as he walks back to the cornfields, Ray Liotta, playing Shoeless Joe Jackson, says, hey, rookie, you were good. And I'm like, that is... like, that's his life right there. So, like, Al Pacino telling you, like, hey, man, you're good. Like, dude, you're floating the rest of your life.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it was. I was like, and it was one of these things where every time we had a break, I would go out outside and call my mother. And we'd just be weeping on the phone. And then I'd come back in and do the thing. But they never knew that every time I left the studio for a couple of minutes between a break, I was crying on the phone. My mother going, you paid my rent and you supported me. And then, I mean, what, you know, weeping, and she's going, you did it. And then I would come in and be like, okay, there was a lot of traffic. I mean, what do you want from us? You know, you go right into it.
Oh, it's perfect, though. I love it. I love everything about your experience. I love the storytelling. Tell us other stories, Patrick. I know you've done The Deuce, Reno 9/11. Any other stuff you want to talk about? Wrote, directed a couple of films, Kansas, Roscoe as well?
Yeah, man. I mean, I don't know what else I tell you. Deuce was a hell of a scene to shoot. You know, very violent scene. Once again, that kind of situation where, as an actor... and, you know, being nude in that scene, gave me a big, nice big bear popularity. I got, you know, I'm big with the Bears. Get a lot of emails from the Bears. And, but, you know, that was the one thing about that scene. I remember when I would sit in the chair, where I was for the majority of the scene sitting in the chair naked. And every time between a take, well, not every time because I made it clear, and a PA would come over with a robe to let me cover my naked body between a setup. And I said, no, don't. I want no robe. And then they would walk away. So I just sat nude the entire time. I was like, if I'm naked, I'm naked. I don't have a robe. So I just, you know, all stocky, sitting in the chair in this old, you know, hotel in Midtown Manhattan, naked for like 6 hours.
Oh.
And then, yeah, Kansas and Roscoe, those are all films that, you know, Roscoe's based on a true story. This bird that I had that literally drove me crazy. And I think my anxiety killed him. And then I felt guilty and gave him a funeral in Harlem. What other things? I mean, yeah, I mean, I got a ton of stories. I got to kind of be inspired, you know, to say them. Boardwalk Empire was amazing to shoot. And a lot of people from Boardwalk that were a part of The Irishman, which was cool. Getting my head bashed in on a beach in Staten Island. Super fun. And, yeah, I mean, ask me anything else. I mean, I could, you know, if you inspire something, I'd tell you a good story.
No, I was about to say, you've been more than generous telling me about The Irishman and that whole scene. I want to tell you how that came about, by the way. I'm watching it, as I said, over and over. And one of my best friends, Husmith Havji, is visiting me. He's an actor himself. And he's watching it. And I go, God, I go, how good is this guy? I go, seriously, how good is this guy? I go, he's perfect. His casting is perfect. I go, he's not too much. He's not too little. He's perfectly serving this. He's so good. And he goes, listen, you got to interview him for Cinephile. I go, what? I go, maybe he's busy, whatever. He's like, no, I'll do it right now for you. IMDb Pro, we get your information. This actually happened. Like, trust me, I'm overjoyed this actually happened. That you had the time to talk to me about it. Because like I said, man, I watch movies and I study them scene by scene. Like, this is, you know, it's like when you take these master classes. Like, that's like anatomy of a scene. Like, I think in the best film of the year, that's the best scene of the year, and you're critical to that. So, I just want to thank you for your generosity. Thank you for the performance. I know you're from Buffalo. Let me close with that. Since I'm from Toronto and you're from Buffalo, I'm going to assume you're a huge cool. Bills fan. If you want to talk a little Bills or Sabres or Toronto or QEW, it's all yours.
Two things I'll tell you right now. Bills, of course, I am because I'm from Buffalo, but I'm not like a big sports guy, so I don't really follow them as much. I follow the heartbreak through my friends. That they have for the Bills. But what I was going to say, just back to that scene one more time, is, yeah, like you're saying, it's a masterclass. I mean, when I left there, I thought, my God, like, how rare is it that as an actor, I got to literally have one of an acting class with both Pacino and De Niro. You know, that's what it was like. And Pacino, particularly, this guy, who is the coolest, mellowest, chillest guy who loves to chat, by the way. He loves to chat. And this guy would say just one line, and it was like a brick dropped from the ceiling and landed on the table. And I remember looking at him going like, oh my God, like that's the work. When you put all that work as an actor behind the words that you're saying, they do hit the ground like 100-pound weight. And everything he said did.
That's awesome, man.
It was something else to be, you know, 4 feet away from him for hours like that, watching the words fall out of his mouth like these stones of genius.
You reminded me now, since you said he's chatty, it's funny. Every interview that I've seen him in, you know, he's so funny because he's just like tangent after tangent, you know, pulling on his hair, and he's kind of just all over the place. And like, he's just, oh, yeah, he loves to talk to theater more than anything. So, like, and it's funny, they did so much together, like Al and Bob in promoting the movie. And De Niro, as always, of course, who I've interviewed before, and he's awesome. Like, he's incredibly generous and he's very smart, very kind.
Yeah.
But by nature, just taciturn, you know, like I picture him just reading and just being by himself and just, you know, that's what he wants to do. Whereas Al, like you said, is very chatty. So I could imagine the two of those guys. It is like kind of like fire and water when you're listening to both those guys, especially being in a scene like that.
Oh, yeah. And there was, and of course, De Niro being much quieter and more selective. And there was one point where we had a break and the two of them are, and Pacino was telling me that he was having trouble FaceTiming his kid, and I can't use a FaceTime, and De Niro just, he goes, well, I showed him how to do it. You know, with this kind of frustration of like, but he just doesn't get it. And I love the idea of De Niro trying to teach Pacino how to FaceTime with his kid.
Well, that's, I'm about to say, Josh Horowitz, a buddy of mine with MTV, he told me, I think Jessica Chastain told him, because he did, Jessica Chastain did Salome, which is a movie Pacino did. It hasn't really been released widely, but it's like one of these passion projects, right? Events, right? Like Looking for Richard and other stuff like that. So she goes, Chastain was telling Josh, he goes, Pacino, he goes, first of all, Pacino, huge texter, which is something I think would be a surprise, and uses a lot of emojis, which I said, that's amazing, picturing Al Pacino texting using emojis right now.
That's amazing. Oh, my God. I would love to see, like, you know, when you open up your emojis, the ones you use most. I would love to see his most used emoji.
He finds like a Shakespearean emoji.
That itself would be an emoji collection.
Oh, yeah. That's amazing. This was amazing. Patrick Gallo is his name. You can follow him on Twitter, at Patrick Gallo, and look out for his work elsewhere. Like I said, he's been in a ton of stuff. Check out his films he's written and directed, Kansas and Roscoe. He's been in Boardwalk Empire, The Deuce, Reno 9/11, and he was a part of my favorite movie, The Irishman. Great stuff, man. Seriously, I can't thank you enough for going into detail about everything. This is amazing to me.
Oh, yeah, and throw up my Instagram, because I spend a lot more time on Instagram, which is, if you don't mind...
Perfect.
Promoting my Instagram, which is and if you know my, it's Chubomatic, Chubomatic. I would highly suggest you check it out, because you, unless you have already, but I do all these weird remakes of 1980s music videos.
Oh my God, think about that cell. I mean, that I'm doing it right now as you're talking. Chubomatic. Yep, I got you.
Yeah, and if you go down a few, you'll see a little collection.
I like the fact that your bio says explicit. Watch 80s video remakes right here. this is great. Everybody follow him. Patrick Gallo, Chubomatic on Instagram. That's awesome.
Yeah, dude. Check it out, man.
All right. Thanks again, Patrick. Take care.
Thanks a lot for having me, brother. This has been fantastic.
Mount Rushmore.
All right, time now for the Mount Rushmore TV spinoffs. We'll mention the show the spinoff was based on and then go from there. Of course, the inspiration is Better Call Saul, which absolutely is on my top list here of the Mount Rushmore, the best TV show spinoffs. Also, The Simpsons. That's right. Joe going next level here. The research, The Tracy Ullman Show was originally what the spinoffs were, so it is technically a spinoff. A show which is going to be around for 40 years, 50 years, who knows? It'll never stop. So The Simpsons obviously is on there. There's two of them. I'd love to get Joni Loves Chachi on here from Happy Days, but that's not going to happen. But I feel like I should give some love here to Mork and Mindy. That's right, from Happy Days. Nanu, Nanu, just for Robin Williams. I got to get one of those on there. And of course, I got to get Frasier. I mean, this is the ultimate heavyweight champion of spinoffs. Like, Cheers is a celebrated, beloved show. And then Frasier won the Best Comedic Series Emmy 5 years in a row. I mean, it was absolutely absurd that it kept beating Seinfeld. I mean, I think it's a great show. I don't think it's as good as Seinfeld. I think Seinfeld should have won more best series than Frasier, but give it up for Frasier. I mean, who doesn't love David Hyde Pierce? Unbelievable as Niles. Obviously, Kelsey Grammer is unforgettable in the role. John Mahoney, really good. Daphne. And the whole show is great. Who the hell doesn't like Frasier? Maybe he shouldn't have won 5 best series Emmys, but it is unquestionably one of the Mount Rushmore spinoffs. So that's my list. Pretty easy one for me, Joe. Better Call Saul, The Simpsons, Mork and Mindy, and Frasier.
I like all those. Yeah, that is a strong list. And I will agree with you on The Simpsons. I also watched and loved Frasier growing up. Since you put that on your list, I will opt and do The Colbert Report instead. So I have The Simpsons, Colbert Report, and then I'm going to go with Family Matters, Urkel. Did
nice.
I do that?
Yes.
Which was a spinoff of Perfect Strangers. And then here's my under-the-radar pick. Most people don't realize that the Andy Griffith Show was a spinoff of the Danny Thomas Show, where Andy Griffith, the character, came on and did a segment on that show. And from there, they thought it was popular enough to start the Andy Griffith Show. So I'll put that one on as my fourth.
Wow, I love it. I thought you were going to start whistling the theme. Yeah, there.
Yeah, and young Ron Howard, who spent off and became a director. So that's how I tie it in.
I love it. And shout out probably the worst one ever, Joey. I mean, just an abomination. I mean, I love Dre De Matteo. Of course, The Sopranos, my favorite show of all time. But Joey, one of the all-time worst shows, I think, in TV history. Who the hell thought, you know, this would be a good show. We'll get Matt LeBlanc from Friends. He'll be the star. Joey Tribbiani, who cares? Like, that show sucked.
100%. And, oh, if I may throw another one on my honorable mentions list, spinoff of Beavis and Butthead, Daria, on MTV in the 90s. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but pretty funny.
Okay. I have not seen Daria, but I like that list there. Give us your Mount Rushmore. As always, you can tweet at Cinephile Pod or Adnan Esfirk. Brett Carrick, Yusuf's coach, will never speak to me again because I did not have Hoosiers on my list of best inspirational movies. So please do let me know where I erred.
Total Recall.
All right, now it's time for Total Recall. The reason, as I mentioned earlier, I wanted to do this is because Peter Fonda was so incredible in Yuli's Goal, which I watched again. I'm like, how the hell did this guy not win an Oscar? Oh, that's right. Jack Nicholson won it for As Good As It Gets. We'll do that in a second. But first, Joe, these are the films from 1997. So the 1998 Academy Awards Best Picture was a little movie called Titanic. What else was nominated?
As Good As It Gets, The Full Monty, Good Will Hunting, and L.A. Confidential.
All right. Well, I'm going to go with L.A. Confidential. I thought it was an amazing film noir. It's a genre which I particularly love. Although I'm not a Titanic hater. I've only seen it once, and I liked it a lot. I saw it in the theater, and I thought, wow, especially the second half. I mean, that's incredible filmmaking and obviously very memorable. I did not expect it to make $1 billion, be the most successful movie of all time. But it's a gigantic movie, big themes. It's not my favorite for Best Picture. I would have gone with L.A. Confidential, but I wasn't angry when it won. I do also really love As Good As It Gets. It's one of my favorite romantic comedies. But yeah, I would go with L.A. Confidential myself, but no real quibbles with Titanic winning.
I love L.A. Confidential, but I will go with Titanic, at least for Best Picture. Just the scope, the scale of it, the sets that they had to build, just everything that had to come together to create that picture as it was, I'll pick Titanic for that reason.
To your point, for Best Director, James Cameron won for Titanic. I think that's a no-brainer. I would have liked to have seen a little love for one of the nominees. Give us the nominees, and I'll tell you who.
Peter Quintanilla for The Full Monty, Gus Van Sant, Good Will Hunting, Curtis Hanson, L.A. Confidential, and Adam Egoyne, The Suite Hereafter.
Yeah, Adam Egoyne's the one I was going to mention. The Canadian director, amazing job with The Suite Hereafter. I'd love to have seen him actually win an Academy Award. He's had a phenomenal career. People in Canada obviously are well acquainted with his films like Exotica and others. But the fact he got nominated for The Suite Hereafter is amazing. It's a harrowing story about a bus crash and Ian Holm playing the ambulance-chasing lawyer. If you haven't seen it, you should check it out and check out the rest of Egoyne's work. But this is a no-brainer, like Joe mentioned, for James Cameron winning. Full Monty, by the way, pretty funny movie. Didn't realize it actually was nominated for Best Director as well. That's kind of shocking now when I think about it. I mean, it's a funny movie, but a bunch of British guys are getting naked to raise money. And yet, that was one of the five Best Pictures of the year, and the director got nominated. So, props to Peter Cattaneo. Not aware of his filmography otherwise. And Gus Van Sant for Good Will Hunting, that's a good reminder. You always think about Affleck and Damon, but Gus Van Sant, pretty good director in his own right. He's the guy who directed it. All right, Best Actor was Jack Nicholson. I mean, listen, he was amazing as Melvin Udall. So funny, caustic, acerbic, a guy battling OCD, yet in love with Helen Hunt. But I've already gone on record as saying I wanted Peter Fonda to win. So Nicholson won, no real issue with it, although I would have gone with Fonda. What were the other nominees?
Matt Damon for Good Will Hunting, Robert Duvall, The Apostle, Peter Fonda, Yuli's Gold, and Dustin Hoffman, Wag the Dog.
I tell you, that's about as good as a Best Actor class as you can get. Oh, yeah. I mean, Damon, right? That's a breakthrough performance for him. Good Will Hunting, he was so memorable and tortured. He was like a young James Dean, you know, you're tearing me apart. Robert Duvall, The Apostle, I mean, a true passion project. I mean, he co-wrote it, he produced it, he directed, he starred in it. That was a real firebrand performance. I would have had no issue if Duvall won. I think The Apostle is one of his, that's probably actually his best acting performance. And I'm including Tom Hagen in The Godfather and obviously Lieutenant Colonel Kilgore in Apocalypse Now, so many others along the way. Hoffman and Wag the Dog is hilarious. I mean, basically he's sending up all those Hollywood producers of the past here. I mean, he's playing Robert Evans, playing a character named Stanley Motz. Great script, co-written by David Mamet. He's got good chemistry with De Niro. When it's cooking, it's cooking. He's got so many good lines in that. But again, I got to go with Peter Fonda here. I'm riding with Peter Fonda, Ulysses Gould. Joe?
You're right. This is acting class 101 with the best actor category. But I will agree with the Academy and go with Jack Nicholson for As Good As It Gets.
How do you write a woman so well? I think of a man, and then I take away reason and accountability. I mean, he is unbelievable. In that scene where he tells her, how he started taking the medication again. I mean, it's so sweet. I mean, that's a really romantic scene that he plays well. He goes, "You make me want to be a better man." And then she says, "That might be the nicest thing I've ever heard." And he goes, "Well, maybe I overshot a little because I was aiming it just enough to keep you from walking out." A great, great scene. Speaking of, the best actress was Helen Hunt that year. What else was nominated?
Helen Bonham Carter for The Wings of the Dove. Julie Christie for Afterglow, Judi Dench, Miss Brown, and Kate Winslet, Titanic.
Wouldn't have minded Winslet winning just because the Titanic glow was so much about James Cameron. She was really good. Julie Christie, speaking of glows, Afterglow, really good movie. But I go with Helen Hunt. I think she was really funny in the movie, dramatic. It was sweet. I think the Academy got it right. I'm glad she won.
I'm agreeing with the Academy a lot this year. So far, I've gone every category with agreeing with the Academy, and that I will continue to do so with Helen Hunt.
Okay, 4 for 4. How about Best Supporting Actor? This was Robin Williams, his only Academy Award-winning performance in Good Will Hunting.
Robert Forster for Jackie Brown, Anthony Hopkins, Amistad, Gray Kinnear, As Good As It Gets, and Burt Reynolds, Boogie Nights.
Well, listen, Robin Williams' Lifetime Achievement Award, I had no issue with. I mean, he obviously was an incredible actor. He was so funny. Good Morning Vietnam, one of my favorites. And so I'm happy he won an Oscar. And I do think, by the way, he was legitimately great in the role. I don't mean to be besmirching by saying, Lifetime Achievement Award. I do think he gave a great performance as, this very kind psychologist who's willing to challenge Damon. And he's also really funny. The scene where he talks about where his wife farts, I mean, they're really funny. But I would have gone Robert Forster, master of subtlety, and Jackie Brown, Max Cherry. I mean, with that cast, you've got Sam Jackson and Robert De Niro and Bridget Fonda and Pam Grier, and Forster steals the entire movie. I thought he was perfection as Max Cherry. I would have given him an Oscar.
He was fantastic in that movie. But I'm going to agree with the Academy again, and I'm going to go with Robin Williams. Just mainly how he juxtaposes Matt Damon's character, and so Robin Williams for sure.
Also, by the way, I wouldn't have an issue with Burt Reynolds winning. He was hilarious as Jack Horner, porn producer. But you're right, this is one of those categories. There's too many other good ones, but I'm glad that Burt got nominated. How about supporting actress? Kim Basinger won for L.A. Confidential. Who else was nominated?
Joan Cusack for In-N-Out, Minnie Driver, Good Will Hunting, Julianne Moore, Boogie Nights, and Gloria Stewart for Titanic.
Gloria Stewart, I believe, was like 92 at the time, getting nominated for Titanic. I would have gone with Julianne Moore. I mean, I thought she was amazing in Boogie Nights. Definitely some overacting, which Bill Simmons has pointed out, the scene where she's talking about, what she did when cheating on her husband and blah, blah, blah. But, Kim Basinger's pretty good in LA Confidence. You know what the hell? I'm going to go with Julianne Moore for Boogie Nights, but I have no issue with Kim Basinger winning. I mean, she's really the female ideal in that movie, right? All these guys, so much machismo, and yet she is the real center of attraction for so many, especially Russell Crowe's character. So I would have gone with Julianne Moore for Boogie Nights because he's like the surrogate mother to Mark Wahlberg's character, but Basinger winning, I have no issue with.
I agree with you. I'm going to go with Julianne Moore, too, for Boogie Nights.
I love it. Okay, best original screenplay. This was a big moment. Matt Damon and Ben Affleck won. What else was nominated?
As Good As It Gets, Mark Andrus and James L. Brooks, Boogie Nights, Paul Thomas Anderson, Deconstructing Harry, Woody Allen, and The Full Monty, Simon Beaufort.
I would have given it to P.T. Anderson for Boogie Nights. I mean, he takes a porn industry and makes it about a surrogate family. He's got unforgettable characters. Just the idea of Dirk Diggler. I mean, Jack Horner. All these guys, Amber Waves, it's really funny, it's really smart, and yet it's surprisingly touching, which I don't know how the hell he's able to pull that off. And that's the mark of a great writer and an also great director. It's a criminal he did not get nominated for directing. Now they look at the list. How the hell did Peter Cattaneo, The Full Monty, get nominated at P.T. Anderson? I would have gone with Paul Thomas Anderson for Boogie Nights. It was nice that Damon and Affleck won. Certainly a good story, good script. I also would have gone, As Good As It Gets, such a funny movie. I mentioned all the one-liners, but I would have gone with P.T. Anderson.
Boogie Nights is amazing. I would normally go with Good Will Hunting. I love the movie, love the script, but honestly, Boston in general wins too much, so I'll go with the full Monty, just because it's funny, and we need more representation of that at the Oscars.
I like it. Good caller. Getting a little comedy love there, and you're right. Boston gets way too much love. I agree with you on that. And best adapted screenplay went to L.A. Confidential. Brian Helgeland and Curtis Hanson adapted from the novel from James Ellroy. What else was nominated?
Donnie Brasco, The Sweet Hereafter, Wag the Dog, and The Wings of the Dove.
I mean, I would have loved to have had a Goya nominated. I mean, winning because he was nominated for The Sweet Hereafter. I mean, double nominee for screenplay and directing. Attanasio, amazing script with Donnie Brasco. I mean, he's a great writer. I love Quiz Show. It's another film that he's done. But I would have gone with Wag the Dog. Again, to Joe's point, satire and comedy never gets much love. I would have loved to have seen David Mamet win an Academy Award. He and Hilary Henkin adapting the novel American Hero by Larry Beinhart. Wag the Dog is an amazing movie. It's really funny, and I wish more people had seen it. But I think people that have seen it know how smart it is and how satirical it is.
I agree with you. I like Wag the Dog, too. For the sake of Total Recall, I will go with LA Confidential, but you're right. It just the satirical aspect of it. It needs more representation at the Oscars. Definitely, we'll agree with.
I love it. But you're right. LA Confidential, definitely a great script. Very sprawling and a very smart story as well. All right. Thanks once again to Patrick Gallo. Follow him on Instagram, Chubomatic, Chubomatic, and follow him on Twitter as well, Patrick Gallo. He was great. Great stories. Thanks as always to my man Joe coming on the train here with like five other people. It's crazy. Everybody stay home, stay safe. I'll be back next week here on Cinephile with a review of, speaking of Boston, a Boston cop show. It's called City on a Hill. It stars Kevin Bacon. It's on Showtime. I'll give you my thoughts on it when we come back. And until then, I'll see you at the movies.